episode 23, recording on the 28th of April 2019, for release on the 30th of April 2019. This is now your post Easter podcast, where Easter eggs are still for sale over here for some godforsaken reason. Andy, after I saw the result in the recent football yesterday, I thought about maybe buying you one and shipping it to you out of pity in some weird way. How are you, my lovely co-host, who is also beleaguered by the footy ball?
Yeah, I mean, at the moment there are two rules in my life. One is don't talk about the football. The second one is don't talk about London Comic Con, because, you know, that's a month away, so trying not to think about it, hoping it'll just go away somehow. So as long as we adhere to those two rules, I am doing great.
Cool. Let's not make a dumb joke about compressing those two things into a single topic, shall we? I'm going to quickly dump that conversation topic and segue right off the edge of a pier. But no, we're not here to talk about football, thank goodness, because man alive, I'd know less than nothing. But this is your fortnightly look at manga, with a focus on joint discussion. We announce our series ahead of time, and so you can join in if you so wish. And the main thing, of course, is that we both read the manga so we can have a nice little discussion and chinwag about it. I'm quite excited about our episode today, which seems a bit mean coming from the actual host, but I think we got a good pair. First and foremost, if you do like this podcast, please consider maybe supporting us on Patreon. For the mere cost of $1 a month, $1 a month, you get a bonus episode every month, and we haven't recorded it quite yet, but I think it'll be a banger, because the light novel Mafia have made us read another light novel for our bonus episode this month, with Do You Love Your Mum and Her Two-Hit Multi-Target Attacks. I forget where the precedence on that title goes in. Good grief. But yeah, you can listen to what you think about that once we've recorded it. So yeah, if you wish to, and you also get to vote on what we get to cover on Patreon. On the Patreon note, once again, thank you very much to Rob Jessup for your continuing wonderful support as a member of our shout-out tier. Also needing a shout out is our returning champion for this episode, which is Golden Kamuy. I don't know if I put this on document or you did, Andy.
That would have been you. I've not read any more of it myself, sadly.
Oh, okay. Do you want me to push this back in the compartment for you
let's go with that. I mean, I've watched, you know, all of the anime, so I'm probably up with at least the events of this. So I'm kind of curious to hear your take on the manga equivalent of it.
Okay, cool. That's fair. Golden Kamuy was announced that it's been added to the Viz Shonen Jump Vault, which is basically, if you have a subscription, you get to have the vault and all the stuff therein. Golden Kamuy being in a strange edge case in that it's considered a more quote-unquote mature title, what with all the frank and frequent murder, and also all the food cooking, which is clearly far too explicit for any mortal to view. At the same time, this is the same app that gives you Chainsaw Man, which is extremely violent, unsurprisingly with the name. But yeah, Golden Kamuy, I have caught up with it using the Viz Shonen Jump website. You have to use the website because the apps won't accept it because of the wonderful wonder of walled gardens like the App Store and Google Play. And yeah, I'm really enjoying it. It feels like it loses its way into a bit of a fog of confusion in volumes 2 and 3, where it starts to introduce lots of different antagonists and also in some cases are not antagonists, but it just has lots of different moving parts that suddenly emerge from the woodwork and are cool and are really fun, but it does lose its way temporarily when you just want to see some more stuff happen. Where I am now, I've just started volume 6 because when you can just read it for free on your browser means you can just burn through it. And yeah, it's still really fun. It's a good romp. It's got a much more interesting cast of extended characters and motivations in play. A lot of very interesting, more sort of aggressive discussions of the time and, you know, the things that men do when they're under stress. You know, it's got lots of grandma respecting, which I can totally get down with. You should respect your grandma, especially when she's helping you not get sniped by some dude. And it has all the sort of lovely anthropology/cooking manga sort of trappings. And, you know, it has some really good characters. It has the Escape King, Shiraishi, also known as the Excrement King, also known as that idiot what got his head bitten by a tanuki. Poor bastard. So, yeah, I'm really enjoying it. It's definitely come back together again in volumes 4 and 5 after the weird interregnum of losing its focus somewhat, introducing all these really fascinating extra character sort of groups, and you're waiting for it to coalesce or at least better demarcate and provide a direction. But yeah, it's really good fun. The art is still kind of ridiculously amazing. It's still terrifyingly violent. Like, I have recoiled more than once from the page because, woof, it does not shy away from showing, you know, just stuff going a bit wrong. And the characters are all a delightful combination of unhinged, but also completely and utterly based in their own reality, in that, you know, a lot of them went through a rather traumatic war, and so of course they've got a few screws loose, because goddamn, they did things and saw things that no one should. So yeah, Golden Kamuy, really good fun, and kind of, if you have a Shonen Jump subscription, I would say that you kind of don't have an excuse to, at the very minimum, check it out, because it's now available on in their subscription. So yeah, I'm really, really enjoying it. Kind of trying to slow my roll now so I don't catch up with the rest of it. I don't know where the anime leaves off, Andy, so I may be starting to get towards points that are going to be new and fresh.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure exactly how far through that goes myself, but the Shonen Jump thing was interesting because I'd actually kind of missed out on that, so that will actually give me all the more impetus to actually go and read some more of it, because... yeah, it's definitely a series. It's a series that I've enjoyed, but have occasionally had like a weird relationship with in terms of its anime outing that I think probably meshes with what you've just said. Like, there are periods where it kind of has to retool itself for what it wants to do next, and sometimes that can be a bit kind of clunky and off-putting. And I think that there are points in that series as well where my interest becomes kind of less in sort of the main overarching storyline and the whole kind of treasure hunt, and more about kind of the stuff going on around that. Like, I'd probably be quite happy if Golden Kamuy at some point just became a series of this bunch of goofballs just like hanging out and doing whatever. And it's like, sometimes it almost feels like, oh, this whole treasure hunt thing is kind of getting in the way of these characters just having fun and eating stuff. And I kind of have this weird sort of almost disappointment sometimes, like, oh, okay, I guess we've got some like major story stuff going on, so I guess we won't be eating squirrel anytime soon. That's kind of a shame. Which is kind of the opposite of most series like this, where you're like, oh, this is kind of a fillery bit. Whereas here, I almost live for those little moments over and above some of the big picture bits.
Yeah, I live for the bit where Shiraishi talks about deep frying whale meat, which made me weirdly hungry. So at the moment where I am right now at the start of Volume 6, they've just had a rather sort of soft reset or refactoring of some of the deeper plot elements, partially because I think that the author themselves looked at kind of how high this cliff was they're going to have to scale with how they'd set out the whole, like, finding convicts and skinning them thing, and was kind of setting up a lot of work with the other sort of elements that are going on. I feel like they kind of wrote too many more interesting storylines or characters sort of directions, and were like, well, shit, I don't want to go back to the original point because that's boring now. So, you know, it's one of these weird things where obviously it'd be lovely to have a conversation with the author candidly to find out what they were thinking about all this. But yeah, it's working well. At the very minimum, as I say, it's very nice that it's in the vault, and so I can just sort of leaf through it a few chapters at a time whenever I feel like it. One thing I will admit is that the reader, the web-based reader, doesn't play nice with mobile browsers on tablets or phones. I mean, it's a very particular use case. Like, I'm reading it in portrait mode on my tablet because that's how I like to read them. But if I try and use the mobile browser, it then displays them in two-page spreads, even when vertically arranged, and I have to basically hold down the spread and move it with my finger, which is somewhat uncomfortable. But if I change to the desktop version of the website, it doesn't allow you to use touch controls and means that you have to use keyboard. So neither really works with my particular use case, but this is hella minor. This is like, you know, just with my personal reading ability. If you sit in front of your computer with a two-page spread open in your monitor, you'll be grand. But it's just one of these things where it makes you appreciate the readers that do work more, when it's like, oh, this is weirdly awkward because I'm clearly not a use case they tested for, because I've just gotten so used to doing this one weird thing.
Yeah, and I feel like kind of web browsers for that kind of purpose have not been deprecated, but probably been forgotten about in the kind of grand shift towards phones and tablets. It's like all of the focus of all of these services is clearly on like, hey, here's the app, download the app, use the app, it's great. And there's very little kind of thought, I suspect, put into the idea that some people are probably actually still reading this on PCs and or Macs, like in any kind of manual way. So that stuff is probably kind of very low on any priority list for stuff, which is a shame, because like clearly there are still people that use that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like in some cases it's going both directions, where, for example, like Comic Walker, which although is a very, very minor player, got rid of both their apps because they said, well, we're not developing them, and we don't really want to keep the developer hanging around doing this stupid app. So they went to web only. And also Bookwalker have deprecated their PC and Mac applications, basically saying, look, if you've got a PC or a Mac, you're likely going to have the internet on it. And if you don't, you'll likely have a mobile and you can use that app instead. So we're not going to keep like four apps updated. That's just silly. We'll cut it down to the mobile platforms and also the web reader, and that'll allow us to do previews and stuff, which is what people always wanted. And that kind of works. So it's, I feel like it's a sort of thing where a lot of people have to kind of evaluate what use cases they want to carry out, want to actually focus on, and then resolve for that value. So cool. So yeah, that's Golden Kamuy. Worth a look. If nothing else. Oh, by the way, Volume 5 is the first real instance of very powerful man service going on. I feel like in later volumes, the sort of reputation of Golden Kamuy precedes it about, man, look at all these buff dudes that you're drawing near naked. And yeah, Volume 5 has a pretty good shot of Shiraishi basically in the buff. Other characters sort of rocking about in this little canoe, and their heads just somehow end up occluding his groin. So it's a good bit of like censorship going on there.
Yeah. I mean, if it's anything like the anime, like it does some really fun stuff with that as well. Like it's very self-aware of what it's doing, and like it kind of, it really leans into just like throwing some of that stuff together in the dumbest way possible, of just like, hey, here you go. You wanted this. This is what you asked for. So like, don't write in. Don't blame me. This is what you wanted. And just kind of leaves it at that. And it's really entertaining.
Yeah. I think it's a case of, you know what this looks like. Maybe you don't know what a guy who's had his face ripped off by a bear claw looks like. I'll show you what that looks like. And it's like, oh no, please don't. Gross. Oh gosh, so many bear attacks. But yeah, that's Golden Kamuy, as I said. So that's a good one. Moving on to our actual picks for this episode. I've already talked quite a lot, so I don't want to take over the entire episode. Do you want to go ahead with your pick first, Andy?
Yeah, sure. So my pick for this podcast is Deadmount Death Play, which is a series written by Ryogo Narita, best known for Jirara and Bakano, two pretty beloved series of people, and quite rightly so. Like they're both good romps. And Narita's kind of a guy who very much has a thing that he is known for in terms of kind of writing stories that feature a pretty large and ever-growing cast of characters and a lot of kind of machinations around them. And to be honest, like Deadmount Death Play definitely leans into that to a certain extent. Like it's not quite as up there as well. I'm not read a huge amount of Bakano, like beyond the kind of the opening sort of volume or so, but like Jirara definitely gets crazy with like the sheer number of characters it has, and thus far Deadmount Death Play has not quite reached those levels yet, which is probably for the best. But anyway, the story starts out actually in a kind of fantasy tinged world of sorts, with a character known as Calamity Crusher, which is also my nickname in the office, funnily enough. No, wait, that's Calamity Causer. Never mind. That's something else. So he's kind of the hero of this piece, and he is kind of about to embroil in this final battle against the Corpse God, who, you know, you can kind of figure out what he is pretty much from the name. Like he's picked a good name for himself there. Both of these characters have this ability called the Evil Eye, which lets them see kind of ghosts and spirits, etc. and kind of like control and manipulate and speak to them, etc., etc. And in the midst of this kind of crucial battle, as things are coming to a climax, some magic happens, and basically one of these characters is transported to our own world. So it's basically a reverse isekai at its core.
Yep, that's my first note.
Yep, and so our character finds himself kind of within the body of this kid who, it quickly becomes clear, like, this kid has basically just been murdered, has basically just, like, had his throat slit, but has effectively been kind of regenerated as the soul of this person from another world. And so, given the situation, this kid, who is called Polka, effectively, it pretty much quickly becomes clear that he's been the subject of an assassination. And of course, the assassin in question, who has just wandered off thinking, yep, job done, that's all sorted, is quickly called back to say, actually, no, the person whose throat you just slit is still, like, wandering around. And so kind of the opening sort of chapters see this assassin return and effectively Polka, as he is now known, effectively has to deal with this issue, which is kind of handy because the one thing he does still have is his ability to see and kind of make use of ghosts and spirits. So even though he's now in a world that basically doesn't really have any magic per se, like, he does still have this ability to kind of control ethereal beings, which lets him kind of win the day against this assassin. And there is a big old kind of twist effectively at the end of this kind of opening skirmish. Because you have effectively far too many isekai stories, etc., have given us a very kind of clear delineation of what happens in these scenarios, and that is that, oh, it's always the hero that gets transported, or, you know, if there is a twist, it's the villain that gets transported, and then there's a big, like, but, dot, 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 afterwards. And it's kind of a little bit of a minor spoiler that you can't really avoid, but the smart twist of Dead Man Death Play is that it's actually the corpse god that has been transferred to the human world, not the hero. Mm. The corpse god, as kind of things pan out, is very much a Ryoge Narita written character in that, like, the starting point is like, oh, this character seems like he's evil, but actually, like, there is a real kind of moral ambivalence to this character in a lot of ways. Like, there are a lot of kind of shades of grey and a lot of kind of twists and turns to what this character considers right, what they consider wrong, and, you know, what they're willing to do for the sake of kind of having what they basically want is a peaceful life and what they believe that to be. And so kind of the corpse god, Polka, as he has now become, effectively kind of falls in with this sort of group of freelance kind of guns for hire, if you like, you know, assassins and mercenaries of some description.
Ryoge Narita secondary characters, maybe.
Which, yes, yeah. So it's kind of a larger than life collection of individuals.
They are. Yeah, no, you're reminding me of a scene that happened.
some other things get thrown into the mix over the course of this first volume. Obviously, the police are kind of involved and quickly become interested in some of this stuff that's going on, which also kind of ties into some of their sort of ongoing investigations. Of course, some of the cops seem to have some kind of like moral ambivalence and some other interests of their own that are pretty heavily hinted at. And there's also kind of another killer on the loose who is weirdly known as Lemmings, which just makes me think of the Amiga game, which is probably not the intended desire.
Volume 2 starts with them going, oh no, and exploding.
Yeah. I mean, if they don't call one of these chapters, oh no, more Lemmings, then, you know, they are missing a trick. Yeah. So there's also this kind of, you know, big bad that is kind of hovering around mostly as just the stuff of legends in this first volume, but you kind of start to see them coming to the fore as this first volume reaches its conclusion. And as a whole, like, I enjoyed this first volume. Like, I liked it. The twist definitely kind of got me and kind of, like, made me feel a bit dumb for kind of presuming so much about what was going on. And it's suddenly like, oh, yeah, like, you never actually explicitly said this, so
yeah.
Why did I make this assumption?
I feel that's a really smart part of this series and kind of did a lot of work winning me over. because in my notes I was like furiously scribbling, going, something's amiss here, there's got to be some kind of twist, there's got to be something here, some of this doesn't quite match up. Oh, and then literally 4 pages before the actual formal reveal, I wrote down, oh, I bet it's the corpse god. Ah, oh, cool. And that was actually quite nice to see, of just, this tallies a lot better. And, you know, it's not like, also the gotcha isn't so huge and pivotal and like waving it in your face that, you know, finding out about it doesn't ruin it. Like, it still works, which was the pleasant part, which sometimes if you figure out the answer beforehand, the series then goes, ah, fooled you. And it's like, no, not really. Sorry. Yeah. But no, yeah, I feel it works really well in this, because it also helps, because if you know, following on from the previous 50 pages of the first chapter, you're like, okay, if it is the hero, this kind of is going to be a bit dull. And then you're presented with, oh, this is a way more interesting, like, character. The character who is now Polka is far more interesting as a result, especially because, like, you later on get their backstory and the whole deal with the corpse god, and either they're very, very good at lying directly to camera, or they're a victim of basic circumstance, like, given their own history. There's a few gaps that seem a bit easy and, you know, sort of serendipitous, but I quite enjoyed that as, like, a setup. You know, it's like, oh, you know, I come from a grimdark world, and here's the hallmarks of that, and here is my backstory. Here we go. So I kind of enjoy that about the whole corpse god character slash now Polka.
Yeah, and it works really well initially, and it's a good journey that it goes on through this first volume, as you kind of start to kind of see where the lines are drawn for that character morally, in terms of like what he sees as okay and what he doesn't. But yeah, like that initial reveal, like there are so many series that would just drop a sudden plot twist on you without any kind of like prior hints or anything towards it, and be like, ah, look at this. This is so smart. But like you say, that it kind of draws that out and kind of ekes out little kind of hints that something is not quite right as it goes along, in a way that is really enjoyable, because it's not a straight sudden like, oh, I think I see what's up here. Like, it's when Polka kind of gets cornered by this assassin and kind of starts to call upon spirits and, you know, basically kind of fuck up this assassin. Like, there's still an argument to be made of like, ah, this could be either of those characters though. Like, yeah, because they're in dire straits in such a way that they may choose to go down this path regardless of whether they're the hero or not.
Well, I mean, in the case, the actual fantasy section does a lot of good work where it kind of lays the seed, saying, okay, they both have the same actual ability and they both have some of the same, like, functions. So, you know, the fact that it does the whole character turn where you see the Calamity Crusher first, really sort of helps lay that groundwork. So I think that really, I feel like it does, it treads the line really well with that initial reveal, which, you know, drags you in pretty good at the end of the first chapter, which is kind of what you need a first chapter to do, quite frankly.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I definitely had that same kind of cadence of like, this feels like something I've read like a dozen times before. And then the further it goes through, the more it's like, oh no, there is something to this. And then, yeah, once it's finished that basic setup, it's like, okay, I'm on board, because you've given me an interesting lead character, and, you know, you've put a decent number of kind of fun and or interesting kind of characters around them that actually they all bounce off of each other quite well. I mean, it's another thing that narrator does really well, is creating a cast of characters that you can effectively lay out in any configuration, and they all kind of bounce off one another in terms of their kind of dialogue and motivations and the way they go about doing things.
I mean, and sorry.
Yeah, I was going to say, it gives them a reasonable amount of kind of scope to do whatever they want to do with those characters moving forward.
Yeah, you're entirely correct, but I don't care about the extended cast whatsoever. I feel like I'm playing myself here almost, but I don't care about the extended cast and most of the actual, like, Ryogo Narita sort of extended elements. Like, I don't care about the assassin is okay, let me start again. So the assassin who, like, kills the main character and is then killed by him and then resurrected, yada yada, she's now a zombie, which means she's now immortal, which seems like a bad idea if you're, like, bringing a unhinged mass murderer back to life as your personal pet assassin, and everyone's just kind of cool with that, or at the very least they're not going to object. And I don't really care about the extended cast. I mean, sure, you're entirely correct. They bounce off each other. The dynamics are interesting. The whole, like, you know, cabaret club / expensive drinking bar, the crooked cops who are probably not that crooked, but act hella crooked to get into the underworld, although everyone already knows their game, which is multiple tiers of, like, subterfuge. There's Drone Lord, you know, your sort of AR, VR, drone, organizing. And also there's a twist involving that and, Polka, which was actually really interesting. And I'm interested to see what the hell they do with it. There's a pet shark, you know, what else do you need? A plush shark. But I really could not bring myself to care about the extended cast or any of their talk. And I just wanted it to be about Polka / Corpse God and his sort of interactions with the new world. And his, you know, he has the whole fish out of water sort of element of not knowing what the hell's going on. He doesn't understand the technology level, but he has a very clear analytical mind. And more than anything, he has the space to examine stuff. And that's what's interesting to me, is the whole fish out of water tale, but with someone who's actually smart and is willing to put in the time, but also has a very different, view and vision of the world. And at the same time, his entire driving force is, I want to have a quiet, peaceful life. And I'm sit there for the entire volume going, motherfucker, move out of Tokyo and buy an allotment. Like, you'll be done. Like, you're done. And then it's only very at the real end of the manga that it actually explains why he hasn't done something like that, which he probably could have figured out because he's a smart lad, is that, oh, well, I'd better figure out who targeted Polka initially because no one seems to know. And that seems important. And also, take care of some loose ends. I'm like, okay, finally. Like, you've actually explained the one glaring hole in this, but I still don't care for the entire extended rest of the cast, like Clarissa, who is the bar owner. I mean, at times it felt like a weird, like, overdone version of Gunsmith Cats, which also has some of the same elements of, like, sexposition going on, which was groan-worthy the moment it turned up. Also, like, the artist Shinsha Fujimoto, very good, but also can only draw one size of breasts, and that size is large, which, hey, man, do what you like, but it looks real boring. Also, he's very happy to have, like, you know, just baps flapping about, honestly, which, you know, sounds prudish, but kind of don't care. It's this exhausting thing of having all these interesting female characters who clearly have their own deals going on, but whenever they're in frame, it's like, hey, cleavage. So
yeah, I mean, like, generally speaking, I like the art style and for the most part the character designs of this volume, but
it's,
like,
very dynamic at least. Like, the fights are good. Like, it has a lot of good momentum and motion. Like, it, you know, you especially when they are, like, flying around and you've got constant drone eye views, and it really helps. Like, the actual fights are very cool, especially when you've got, like, a combination of, you know, weird super assassins and drones and tech and guns and idiots in suits and weird magical skeleton hands, which, you know, it all works. So
yeah, and it's like, if it could just knock off some of the male gaze, like, I think that would be much, much for the better. Like, it's the thing I felt like reading through this first volume in particular is, it felt like one of those series that was very desperate not to get cancelled early on, and so it's kind of gone for the low-hanging fruit of just like, I'll put a sex scene in, and I'll put some boobs, and I'll put some panty shots in there, because that'll probably hook some people in enough that, you know, we can keep this truck going until, you know, we get kind of a dedicated base of people that will read this regardless. Like, I feel like I've seen so many series that are actually, like, good series that feel like they have to start from that baseline just in case. And it's always kind of disappointing to see, but, like, it definitely feels like one of those. I'm kind of curious to read future volumes to see if they just knock it off, because, like, okay, we've made it through, like, the first few chapters now, so hopefully we've got people on board.
Yeah, I mean, we see the volume has a decent number of chapters. One thing to note is that this series, we read the first volume, which has only just recently been released, but it is being simulpubbed by Kodansha, and it's up to 28 chapters, which is a good number of volumes, honestly, given how long they are. And this is one that's been coming out every month, you know, and, you know, looking at the preview art for most of them, I can see that it's going to do a lot of the same gazy stuff, which, again, my main complaint isn't so much the male gaze, although that is a problem. It's more the fact that I just do not give a rat's ass about any of the secondary cast. And the amount of time that they have is just really wearing on me, where towards the end of this volume, I was getting really bored because it's like, I don't care about the weird Hostess Club assassins. I don't care. I mean, I care about Drone Dude and I care about the sidekick assassin boob lass, like victim, but I, and also like, and like, I care about the main character, but the rest of it, I really don't care about. And even the main character, like his motivations, like there's one thing about this series in particular that is like a deeper root of that is it has intense tone whiplash constantly, where it goes from 0 to 100 within panels. It's wild. Like sometimes it's like, oh, I want to have a peaceful life, but I will murder everyone. It's like, oh, okay, we'll get to the bottom of this. We'll end your guts. And it's just like all this, it keeps flipping off between like tone really fast. And I, you know, I guess that's part of the series charm where it wants to be kind of unhinged and unpredictable and kind of, woo, what's going to happen next? But at the same time, it's very exhausting to read when it just keeps doing it constantly. And it doesn't really seem a surprise anymore. It just seems annoying where I can't just watch things play out. I don't know. Maybe it's just me, but I did you experience that at all, Andy, in reading it?
Yeah, I mean, actually, kind of one of the one question we got from our Twitter comments was from friend of the show, Demarza Ward, who asked, like, does Dead Mount Death Play live up to Ryuga Narita's usual blend of delightful drama and comedy? And it does, but I think it also does have that exact problem you've described where it flips between the drama and the comedy, or between elements of that drama or that comedy, in ways that do give you that kind of whiplash. Like it struggles to mesh those two things together in a way that I certainly wouldn't use the word delightful for it. Like it has those elements, and in isolation, both of those things can work well, but it really struggles with shifting gears from one to the other. Like it sometimes drops comedy in just kind of, you know, like an atomic bomb out of nowhere that it just doesn't feel right. And sometimes, like you say, it kind of it shifts from one angle of discussing something to another in a way that is less than satisfactory. And it's kind of, you know, I feel like it's one of the things that stuff like Durarara does really well, is it kind of, it manages to juxtapose its drama and its comedy in ways that just feel really organic and fit. Whereas this feels very much almost like a kind of, and perhaps it's partly down to just, you know, the trials and tribulations of like paneling and writing out a manga, but it kind of, it flips from panel to panel in terms of what it's trying to do. And sometimes that can be less than satisfying.
Yeah, I feel like the one thing it doesn't really manage to do is like consistency of tone, at least. Like I know I've spent most of my time ragging on her, and I can't remember her name still, but the primary female character, like the former the current assassin, former murderer of main character,
Misaki,
she's an interesting character. Like she's very much manic pixie dream girl mixed with murder, but then hell, look at My Hero Academia, everyone freaking loves the murderer in that one. But it's a problem where it's like even she can't really handle a level, and it gets very tiring to even just interact with her character in a scene where she'll jump between different states. I mean, which probably speaks to her character, but at the same time it flips between high drama and low drama all the time, and when it does jump onto comedy, it doesn't feel like it's in a place where it should be jumping to. It's like, oh, okay, I thought we were being serious, or were we? I don't know anymore. So it's very tiring to read as a result.
Yeah, I mean, I think kind of my take on that as sort of a general point is I liked all of the characters enough that I'm probably willing to give it at least another volume to see what it does with those characters. Because like I feel like there's enough unsaid and unspoken about those characters that there could be interesting stories to come from them. And I mean, if Ryuga Narita's kind of previous work is anything to go by, you know, every character usually gets their due at some point. And I'm kind of hoping that characters like Misaki and some of the other characters who are kind of very much just sort of, they're there, they do their bit, and that's kind of it. Like I feel like I like them enough that I'm hoping that we get to see a deep dive into those characters, or that they get drawn into the story in a way that kind of lets us see a little bit more of them beyond just their kind of, you know, core characteristics. And yeah, that may be folly on my part, and it may be that none of that stuff ever really gets kind of, you know, delved into in any kind of way. But it's like, you know, these characters seem decent and potentially interesting enough that I'd like to think that there'll be a backstory to come that will be like, okay, yeah, this was kind of worth hanging around for.
Yeah, I feel like where the volume leaves off is a really good crucible for the characters to be thrown into, if that makes sense. Like, I feel like if there's going to... if we're going to see the characters come into their own, both individually and as a group, and all their different little factions and all the different rivalries they've got going on, I feel like where the first volume leaves off is kind of the perfect setup to see what's going to happen now, which sounds like a cop-out on my part, and it kind of is, but I feel like if I read one more chapter, I will then have a more conclusive opinion on where I stand on it, because although I've talked an awful lot of Yang, there's still some really good ideas here, like from the initial sort of like, surprise, it's a reverse isekai, and surprise, the villain is now the main character, and surprise, the main villain wasn't actually the baddie. You know, it's kind of done enough good stuff and it has enough obvious care. I mean, part of me just wants to see the main character, Polka, like, do his thing, because he's the most interesting character by half, and kind of fades into the background in the second half because it's got all the rest of the cast set up and all their different deals, which, you know, is okay, but I almost just want the, like, all Polka time, which sounds like a very strange satellite channel almost. but yeah, that's kind of the bit I care about, but at the same time, it's a Ryogo narrative work. Like, they want to have their gangsters and they want to have their sort of, like, wheeler dealering. So here we are.
Yeah, I mean, even Polka's kind of abilities and the whole evil eye thing, kind of, that sits perfectly in terms of making him the character that you want to see having to handle problems the most, because it's not like, again, to kind of go against the isekai grain, like, he's not the crazy OP character, like, there are certain situations and places where he is that character, but, like, they are very few and far between in the world, so, like, it's a question of, you know, either every action scene or every kind of scene of drama and peril involving him is going to have to, like, take place in, you know, a graveyard or somewhere where a lot of murder has happened, or they're hopefully going to do interesting things where he's going to be kind of caught in places where he can't just use his powers to fix this problem and he's going to have to be way smarter about it. And that's kind of, like, in terms of the main character, that's also kind of what I'm in for, is like, okay, this guy is smart, like, let's see that put to the test in kind of interesting ways above and beyond what we've seen in the first volume, that's always been like, oh, there's been a bunch of murder in this place, so lots of ghosts around.
Yeah, the Knight Rider problem. but yeah, I agree with you. I feel like it's very smart where, you know, it very clearly demarcates the abilities of the main character. You know, they're in control of supernatural magic, but it has very clear limits. And also the main character himself is prudent enough to know that, hey, I can't go using this. Like, this has got to be very carefully used. So, and also if I don't have access to it, I'm basically just a smart dude in a child's body with a sick scar on my neck. That's it. Like, I'm not actually, like, a buff dude. So that's interesting, honestly. But yeah, I feel like I'm curious to see what happens with Lemmings. but other than that, I feel like I'm almost set myself up for disappointment, because I almost feel like I'd like this less if it wasn't a Ryogo narrative work, because it has all their other, like, stuff they're good at, like, don't get me wrong, but those are things I'm not looking for in this series, which means that, hey, I'm just pointing the gun right up my foot now. So yeah, that's enough from me on that.
I think for me it's certainly a case of like, I enjoyed what is here, but it is definitely one of those ones where, like, I feel like the second volume might be a kind of make or break, because if it just carries on down the exact same path or kind of runs out of road, which I feel like I can definitely see a future where this just runs out of ideas really fast, then, you know, that would be really disappointing. But I can also see a possibility for it where, you know, it kind of really manages to hone in, to keep doing the stuff that is good, but kind of hone in on the stuff where it's kind of naturally been a bit weak in the first volume. And if it can bring the best out of kind of its extended cast, then I could see myself being on board for it. So I'll probably try and pick up volume 2 once that comes out and see how it goes from there.
Yeah, at the minimum, I think it definitely has, like, a good set of ideas to play with. So, you know, that's, you know, there's hope for it, frankly, which, you know, I've sounded really negative on it, but I still had a fun time reading it. And also, you know, small note, don't read this in your local charity shop cafe, because if an old lady walks past you and looks over your shoulder, she might see a whole page load of lesbian sex, which, yeah. I had to close the tablet pretty fast there and pretend nothing was wrong.
That did catch me very much unawares. Cause it's like, okay, you know, there's been some mild fan service here. This is your pretty, like,
there's
traditional
been some hilarious
manga,
violence, you know.
Yeah, exactly. It kind of hit all the notes I was expecting from this series. And then I split the page like, oh, well, okay, yes, that's a thing that two women can do. I was just not expecting it in this manga, so thank you.
Don't exposit while tribbing. It's just rude. Come on.
I mean, it did seem like the focus was in all the wrong places there. But anyway.
Even when the character points that out and it's like, hey, shouldn't you be focusing on something right now? Nah, I'm going to exposit. And my phone's going off, because of course it is. Oh, that was pretty daft. Anyway, so yeah, that's we've covered the question. So yeah, that's Dead Mount Death Play. As mentioned, it's got one volume out so far, and it's got 28 chapters available, individually purchasable, thanks to Kodansha, because they're doing that whole nonsense. It's not complete, obviously. It's being simulpubbed because it's ongoing in Japan. So hooray, new content. Right. So that's been that, and now on to our second series for this episode. My pick of Mario Carter and now Emoto's O Maidens in Your Savage Season, Volume 1. Mario Carter is, well, an anime writer and screenwriter of some repute. The writer of, is it award-winning? It should be. Award-winning Macquia, When the Promised Flower Blooms. She has won the award for that, right? Or am I making that up?
I don't know whether... I mean, it probably has won some award somewhere. I don't think it's had any, like, kind of massively... You know, it didn't get nominated for an Oscar or anything. Mirai.
But anime never wins an Oscar, so whatever.
No, indeed. But she's certainly won numerous awards over her career for her writing. And,
there we go.
She's very much a fan darling with good reason for her writing chops.
At the same time, you could probably put an asterisk next to darling, because sometimes when you tell people it's a Mario Carter work, they go, ugh, and then you get a 5-tweet string about why they don't like her. or at least are very suspicious of her, which, frankly, the suspicion may well be justified, but hey, I think she's definitely had some growth. Anyway, the artist, now Emoto, has done a series called Forget Me Not before, which is all available digitally. This manga is published by Kodansha. It's got 6 volumes out in Japan. It's currently ongoing. We reviewed the first volume, which is all that's currently available. It's available from all good digital stockists. And just to put the sort of like verdict line at the top, I really loved this volume. I was blown away by it. After I kind of read the back of the book, Precy, like the synopsis, and looked at the front page and was like, okay, you know, it sounds a bit hacky, but you know, anything about like a coming of age story / you know, puberty story sounds okay. It certainly seems a lot more interesting and involved than all the chaste romance stories you can read where it's like, oh no, Takeshi-kun, blah, childhood friend, blah, 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 blah. Maybe I'll confess under the oak tree. Whereas it's much more about, hey, I've got all these hormones. Everyone else has got all these hormones. Shit. And it kind of goes from there. So the actual series is about 5 girls who are in a literature club at school, and they are reading a rather graphic depiction of a sex scene, including some hilarious metaphors thereof, including a warping of the phrase pork stew, which has had me in stitches ever since I read it. So that was great. Thanks, Mario Carter, for ruining Tanjiro for me. And so they start talking about sex and all about that, and like, oh, you know, oof, heavens, you know, the leader is very, very prudish. She has very thick glasses and very long black hair that's put back in a very long ponytail, and extremely prudish. She's very much the like class rep character. And she's like, and then there's the main character who I already forgot the name of.
Kazusa.
Yeah, she's great. She's a little sweetie. She is the main character who is like kind of very much tossed and turned by this ongoing wave of sexual awakening that sweeps over the cast as they basically start reading books and discussing amongst themselves like sex and everything around it and their personal opinions and matters. They have the quiet girl who is herself an amateur writer, who also appears to have the worst editor, just the worst sort of person to talk shit about her writing to her. You have the quote-unquote angel surrounded by trash, Nina, who is like traditionally extremely pretty, and is herself a very fascinating character, because given that she's pretty, everyone is kind of feeding after her, but it also leads to the side effect where she gets tons of unwanted advances from people, but just, you know, because she's actually traditionally and sort of conventionally attractive. And that kind of comes into play later in the volume in a really fascinating way, that is almost like, explaining patriarchy in modern society 101 if you're a doofus like me, and then you go, oh yeah, this is like basics of, you know, the transactional nature of, you know, gender relations and how it's frigging toxic and horrible, and people have to basically learn to shield themselves, but when they're like 10 from it, because people are gross. And that's
and the amazing thing is it does that really well in like two panels as well.
Oh yeah,
it lays it out in a way that's just like, oh shit, yes, nailed it. Okay.
Yeah, sorry, I've been rambling at length, but you know, it does that really well because it introduces it, it resolves it, it has some funny comedy moments as a result, and it doesn't like try, it doesn't sit you down and make you walk through like a really boring tweet thread about it. It's instead, hey, here is an illustration of why this sucks, and here is why it still sucks, and here is why it also sucks, and here is how you escape it without getting basically raped. So, you know, it's, I was really fearful for the series when they started to introduce that angle with Nina, and the way it resolves it is really smart, but also still kind of sad, where it's like, man, Nina, you poor bastard. Yeah. But yeah, so the main character herself, Kazusa, so was it? I forget.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Kazusa, sorry. Yeah. Oh, I wrote it down and I've lost it in my notes. So Kazusa herself, it follows Kazusa in particular and how she is having a sexual awakening for her childhood friend, her neighbor next door. The sort of very, very attractive, football guy / train nut, but he's very conventionally attractive. And so he has girls kind of like keep hunting for him. Izumi, that's it. And Izumi is, you know, he kind of lives alone next door because his mum's constantly being chased out of the house by their crazy grandma, at least that's what I could gather. It's a Mario Kart work, so of course families have got to be somewhat broken in some manner. And so basically she walks on him whacking it at one point, which leads to one of the best two-page spreads I've ever seen in a manga, perhaps. But is just really funny, and it doesn't really need to censor anything, but just captures the like horror of basically being walked in on while having a wank. Also to something that you probably shouldn't be looking at and makes you look quite bad as a person. And then the delayed reaction. So yeah, basically it kind of goes from there about Kazusa having her own awakening about Izumi. You have the class president who leads a one person campaign against the word sex and demands everyone come up with alternatives for it. You have the choir author who is having her own travails. You have Nina, trying to avoid basically like being harassed constantly because she's attractive. And then you have the like little friend of Kazusa, who is basically just a tiny little sweetie pie with pigtails who hasn't had anything to do just yet. But no, it's really fascinating. It's very dynamic. It has really, like, I love the characters, as if that's kind of not obvious already. The characters are also kind of very much in control of themselves and are aware that they're kind of a mess, but each of them have their own different angle on what's happening and their own personal opinions and their own personal targets. And it even has cases where even like the nominal bullies still have human moments. Like after Sonizaki, the class president gets basically bullied in PE class. Like there actually is a lingering shot where they're like, oh, that was pretty shitty of me actually. Shit. And it's like, oh, okay. This series is actually like going to be at least trying to be nuanced about it. And, you know, but also play with attractiveness and, you know, admiration and such. So I really enjoyed it. And the end of the volume comes with a massive kicker, which, like, forgive me for the rather cliched phrase, but has the potential to turn their world upside down. So yeah, as if you can't tell from me rambling on kind of nonstop, I really love this volume. I found it really fascinating and a really fun read, but also really kind of not grimy. I mean, it's not like Flowers of Evil style sexuality where it's just kind of gross and grimy and festery. It's very much a self-discovery process of these characters going, well, I think this, but why do I think that? I don't know if I do think that. I'm not quite sure. Do I like this person? Oh no. And it kind of does a lot of really fascinating work. And the art is ridiculous. Like it's really, really good. It has tons of good use of paneling and it has some really amazing both single page and double page spreads that are just really good. There's a part where basically a character is like snooping on someone being confessed to, and there's an amazing vertical panel layout where said character finds out and is like storming towards the camera, and yeah, it's from the camera's point of view. It's a really great piece of, because it communicates so much. You know, you can see the character's facial expression, you can see the facial expression of the people who are on the other end of the live stream, because hey, it's 2019, y'all, you can live stream people's confessions over line. Oof. And it's great. I love it. I really enjoyed it. And the kind of the kick in it was that I got to the end and found out the second volume isn't out yet. So whoops. But yeah, it's real good. The art and the characters all look really different, look really engaging, but at the same time, they don't just look copy pasted. Like Sonny Zaki and also the writer, all have individual personal looks, but also, you know, they're not just like set design moving across. So yeah, it's real good. So yeah, sorry, Andy. I'm going to have a breath now and let you actually get a word in edgewise. Apologies. What did you think of this?
Yeah, I'm pretty much with you on it. Like, I really, really enjoyed it a lot. Yeah, like, I mean, art style-wise, yeah, I love the character designs, and everything about the presentation of this volume is just absolutely spot on. Like you say, kind of the panelling, the way shots are laid out, it all just works so well, you know, no matter what it is that it's trying to do. And yeah, like, I mean, there was a point where I kind of find myself thinking like, maybe it's a little too kind of all consuming in the way that like everybody is talking and thinking about sex all the time. But then I kind of find myself like reflecting back on kind of my own sort of like secondary school / high school years, and realized that there was very much a period of like probably not even an entire school year, but there was definitely like a period of a good kind of 6 to 9 months where pretty much that exact thing was going on. And there was just this weird kind of moment where I guess it was just that there was sort of a groundswell of enough people who would kind of, you know, were far enough into puberty to care about this stuff, where like basically your entire kind of societal position was based on your sexual experience. And I think one of the things this volume does so well is the way it kind of holds up that whole kind of us versus them vibe, that there are kind of people on the we don't have any sexual experience side of things who are just kind of like kind of trying to figure out like what the heck the whole thing's about, why is it important, etc. And then there's also that kind of desire like, oh, we, you know, this is something that I need to figure out and that I kind of want to try. And there is this weird kind of like divide that opens up between people like, oh no, like, you know, they're virgins and we're not. And it's this almost weird kind of like secret society kind of thing. And I think it's a split that this kind of book just absolutely kind of nails perfectly in terms of kind of the characters who are sort of feeling like they're on the outside of this kind of club, and they're not even sure whether they want to be in that club or not, or what it means and all of that stuff. And it just gets that perfectly. And I think it does really good stuff with all of the characters around that. I mean, I think Kazusa's character in particular, like, as well as just being a really enjoyable character in her own right, like, the way it plays with kind of the whole childhood friend convention over the course of this volume is just absolutely spot on.
Yeah,
because
it's
kind of, it's this weird kind of thing of like, oh, like, this kid I've been hanging around with, who was just like kind of a goofy idiot that I used to hang out with because we were neighbors, like, he's kind of hot now, but also like he's just my pure little kid friend that I've always known. Like, he would never like have any dirty thoughts or anything, because like he's just this kid that I've always known. And it's like, oh god, no, he like, oh he totally has sexual thoughts, and wait, how does sex even work? Now I'm even more confused. And it's like that whole arc and all of the confusion around that is just so well played, like, especially against kind of the typical sort of childhood friend angle that you tend to see in manga, which is kind of pretty boring and well worn in terms of like, oh, I like my childhood friend. Like, the conflict and the way that it's shown up in this volume is just like, it's really great. And it sets up the series as a whole as kind of a really good center point for what's going on, and kind of like the confusion and the conflict, and, you know, trying to figure out all these kind of raging hormones. And it's just like, it's a really excellent kind of piece for everything else to revolve around.
Yeah, definitely. Especially because the whole childhood friend angle gets used both by Kazusa and by everyone else around her, both like sort of leaning on, but also weaponizing it at different points. Like, you know, she complains bitterly to her friend saying, ugh, middle school was such a pain because I was still like friends and we were still kids, but everyone took it out on me because I was childhood friends with him, and suddenly he was hot and everyone was after him, and I was seen as this obstacle, but I totally wasn't. And now it's, you know, now she's having her own awakening of like, oh, he kind of is hot, but I remember him being cute always, and he's still cute, but what did I see there? But then also their discussions between themselves, because they actually try and talk it out at one point, but that kind of gets cut off because they don't really know how to talk about it. I mean, Kazusa is particular, like, God bless her, she has the heart of a lion. Like, she goes to a bookstore and tries reading, like, a parental guide to sex about how to deal with your teenage hormonal son. And then even almost asks her dad about it, which I feel like, holy shit, you have a good relationship with your dad if he's, one, willing to buy you pizza, and two, you're about to ask him about whacking it. So, yeah, it was pretty wild. I mean, even, like, she even has a really, like, you know, her way of framing everything is kind of spot on. Like, I remember, much like yourself, like I remember my later, my sort of teenage years when it was basically just nothing but talking like idiots about sex and nothing else. Like, hell, my extended friend group had the person we called, like, the, you know, the slut virgin, who talked about sex non-stop. Everything had to be an innuendo. Everything had to be a non-sequitur. Everything had to be a double entendre. But herself was extremely shy and chaste, and her boyfriend were the sweetest pair of idiots, who were lovely people to hang out with, like, lovely kids. But at the same time, it's like, holy shit, can you please just lose your virginity and shut up about this for 5 minutes before you deep throat another sausage roll in the lunchroom? And, you know, dumb shit like that, because we were idiot 17-year-olds who were, like, way too horny and way too stupid and way too, like, and didn't have any ability to exercise any of it. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it does absolutely nail that. And it also kind of, like, I also find myself thinking about this series as kind of the flip side to the coin of A Scum's Wish. Because, like, that is a manga series where all of the teenage characters basically use sex as the solution to all of their problems. And it's just like, like, you know, I'm in love with somebody who I can't be with, or whatever it is. I'll just get laid. This'll probably fix things, I guess. And, like, this feels like the exact kind of opposite side of that coin, where sex is kind of the problem. And it's just like, it's just this sort of insurmountable, like, you know, how do I even tackle this? This whole thing is a mess. Like, how come people are having sex? How does that even work? Like, yeah. You know, we're just here, just kind of like even figuring out whether I like somebody or not, and yet other people are here doing this, that, and the other. And it's kind of like they feel like they're both very valid kind of takes on how teenagers deal with sex. And, like, I feel like as a duopoly of stories that kind of focus relentlessly on that above all else, they kind of work really well as the two counterpoints to one another.
Yeah, you get Sonizaki, the leader of the group, who, like, basically more than once basically stands up and yells "Sexta Lenda Est," almost. And she's a fascinating character, like, because I was really worried initially she was just going to be this, like, cardboard cutout butt of jokes, and then quickly establishes her own storyline, which, like, some of the, like, Mario Kart once again depicting bullying in a very, really fascinating light, because, you know, by her admission, has had experience of it, and so is really good at depicting the, like, even just the weird psychological barbs and elements of being bullied in different ways. At the same time, also seems to make the characters way more believable and more earnest. So, yeah, I'm gutted that volume 2 isn't out already, because as soon as I finished the first one, I was like, oh, damn, I want to read more. Oh, it's not out. Shit.
Yeah, yeah, I definitely had that sinking feeling when I got to the end of this volume, and, you know, you get the little kind of, hey, buy volume 2 right now button if that volume is available, and there was nothing. It's like, oh, I'm going to have to wait now.
Yeah, but also there's a side... Yeah. Oops, sorry.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, as well as kind of all the character stuff, like, it's also worth noting, like, this is a really funny manga.
Oh, totally.
As well.
I was about,
like,
to say,
it's
as
comedy,
well.
Its comedy is absolutely, like, on the nose. It just absolutely lands it pretty much every time. I mean, again, you're talking about the whole kind of, like, live streamed confession. It's just like the line after Izumi kind of storms up to Nina and is like, what the heck are you doing? Like, oh, oops, I forgot to run away. And it's just these little kind of moments of just, like, sheer stupidity, and kind of, again, like, people trying to figure out, like, nope, we can't use the word sex anymore, we need alternatives, and all this kind of dumb stuff, which, again, there's something kind of believable about it from this group of characters, of just like, yeah, this is the kind of stuff that would go down amongst them.
That is such a good part, because it leads to, like, a 2-page long gag that when you start it out, you think, what the hell is... Oh, no. And it's a great gag as a result. Like a two-line gag that just leads to someone snapping a pen in half, which itself is a really good... Like, some of the... Like, there's a real smart use... sorry to drag this back in again, but there's such a smart use of paneling in this manga, like, for timing, where you just... Like, you get the resolution to a dumb gag storyline, and you just get this amazing page of, like... impact, weight, reaction, and it's just great stuff. And again, the art looks amazing and the gags are hilarious. Like, it's some great facial expressions, unsurprisingly, some good blushing, some good goony comedy. There's a weird Top Knot joke at one point. Yeah,
yes, there is.
So funny. But yeah, it's so funny. I mean, I just really enjoyed it start to finish. One last thing I want to point out, actually, before I forget about it, is this is so minor and so nerdy, but the way it does translation notes are great, because what it does, I mean, you don't need, I mean, to be fair, it kind of pads them out. You don't need two to a page, but what it does is it has a cutout of the panel in question, so it's in context. It mentions the term and then explains it. Like, just the fact that they put a cutout of the panel there so you can see it in context rather than looking at it and go, page 93, which one's page 93? Oh, okay. Like, really smart. Really, really, really smart. So yeah, I'd love to see that done more often, because it just makes the translation notes way more engaging and also way more immediate and kind of just really smartly done.
Yeah, for sure. That was kind of it was one of those volumes where I didn't particularly need any of the translation notes, but it's like, yeah, this is kind of a good kind of gold standard for how to depict them if you possibly can, because it's definitely a big improvement over the norm of just like dropping them all in a page, just like, oh, this was on page whatever without any kind of reference.
Yeah, it's really smart. Probably a lot of work, so thank you whoever did do that.
Yeah, probably. But yeah, I was just going to kind of say, like, as a final thing in terms of the paneling, etc., I'd actually be really curious, and you know, this will probably never happen in any kind of interview, but I'd love to know kind of the process of creating this, in terms of, you know, how much of that is kind of Mario Kart's direction and how much of that is now Emoto just, you know, doing that with the artwork, because it kind of, there's a real kind of anime styling, I feel like, to some of the paneling and some of the framing and blocking of characters that kind of made me think, like, you know, is Mario Kart actually giving quite a lot of direction here in terms of, like, hey, here's how this should look, here's, you know, that this should be effectively a big kind of panning shot or a two-page spread. Like, I'd be really interested to know what that kind of division of labor was like, because it's definitely one of those series that it felt very anime-like to me in some of its kind of pivotal points in terms of how it was depicted. And, like, given that Mario Kart has now, you know, tried a hand at storyboarding and direction with Machia and so on and so forth, like, I was kind of really curious as to whether that was part of kind of that had come off the back of that experience, or whether it's just actually that, you know, the artist just happens to be incredibly talented at getting that stuff right.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that artists have done before is Forget Me Not, which is all labeled digitally and I believe physically. I'm not quite sure. Don't hold me to that. But I almost, reading this, maybe want to go back and at least buy the first volume of that and read it, just to compare and contrast what, you know, now Emoto does on their own versus with Mario Kart. But yeah, really, really enjoyed this, kind of cover to cover, blasted through it, laughed my head off, really felt for the characters, laughed at the characters, sort of loved it entirely. Volume 2, when, please?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's one of those things that I want to read it for its entertainment value, and I also want to read it because I kind of care about all of the characters already and kind of what happens to them, you know, kind of as we were talking about with Dead Mount Death Play, like, that's an important thing, whether you actually care about those characters or not. And I feel like, especially for a series like this, where you've got kind of a set of characters in a club, it's always the risk that it comes down to being like, oh, I like this character, but I don't really care about the rest of them, or maybe actively dislike them. Whereas here, like, every character is kind of set up enough that you kind of want to see what comes next for them. Like, I feel like the only character that really doesn't get any play is Momoko. She's just kind of the character that is mostly just there. Like, she doesn't really seem to be having any particular turmoil of her own.
She's just the friend at the moment, isn't she? So
yeah. Like, I'm curious as to, like, I kind of hope that character gets a bit more justice done to her in future volumes, but, like, all of the other all of the other members of that group all have kind of interesting stuff going on, or there's kind of, there's something to them that you kind of want to see fleshed out in some shape or form, because, you know, there's clearly a lot that they can do with those characters, and there's a lot that they need to kind of tackle in future volumes. Yeah. So please volume two quickly.
Yeah, I'm really, like, it sounds real dumb, but I'm really worried for most of them, because it's like, you can see the seeds of possible future downfall or just emotional pain later. Like, there's a lot. I don't want to talk about it in particular because it's just basically spoiling the entire thing of character arcs. But man, I'm really worried about them. Which, you know, yeah. I think is a good sign that I care about the characters enough to fret about them like some idiot, like fake parent.
It's also kind of weirdly, again, kind of a turnaround on the norm in that I feel like Kazusa is probably the character that has their shit together the most. Like, she's kind of the one that is at least thinking things through and like doing some research and stuff. And like, as fumbling as she is, she's kind of at least got her head screwed on somewhat.
Nina has her head screwed on, although in a very particular way, because she's had to deal with unwanted advices for a large majority of her life. And so that kind of puts her in a strange position of both being the one who is the most like vocally open about sex, but also is the one who kind of has the least interest or desire for it, because her basic sexual history has been trying to get rid of dudes who are hitting on her. So, you know, I'm really worried. I'm interested to see what happens to her in particular. And also the writer character, the mop-headed one, who basically so far has been quite quiet, told a teacher to go die, and also appears to be like talking in a sex chat room. Like, so it's like, hang on, like this could go bad for you. I hope you're okay.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's kind of where my thinking comes from. Like, Kazusa seems like the one who's not going to do anything stupid. Like, I feel like all of the others, like, including Nina, could just something really kind of like have a moment, a very teenage moment of madness and do something they regret. Whereas Kazusa is the one who I feel like if something weird was about to go down, she'd probably just go to her dad and said, "Dad, we need get the pizza in. Like, we need Domino's.
Help! No pineapple." Yeah, I feel like Momoko, if anything, I reckon she's going to be the spoiler gag of the series, where we'll get to like volume 5 or something, and all the rest of them will still be in conniptions about everything. Meanwhile, she just walks in with her boyfriend, and he's like, "Hey, check out my hubby." I'm like, "What? What were you doing off screen?" "Well, I got pregnant. Check it out. I'm going to be a mum." Like, what the fuck? Like, yeah. I doubt that will happen entirely, but it would be pretty funny.
I don't know. That is also exactly the kind of thing that I wouldn't put past Mario Kart.
Yeah, there is that. But yeah, really enjoyed it. Great time. Really, really lovely. Cool. So, Nish, anything further to say about it?
No, I think that's it. I think we've said enough good things to hopefully other people want to read it.
Yeah, totally. So, talking about things we want to read, what we'll talk about next time. So, first up, I have chosen the recently published Dempa title, Maiden Railways, which is slightly awkward to find digitally. I think it's on Kobo. Did you find it in the end, Andy?
We were both
scratching our head trying to find the damn thing.
Yeah, it's been a weird thing with a few titles recently where they're just shown up on Kindle as unavailable, and it's not available on any other digital platforms. So I kind of sent out the help, Elliot, I can't find this bat signal. And yeah, he pointed me in the direction of Kobo, which I hadn't even thought about. And they gave me £3 off, so I got it real cheap. So yay.
Yeah, I use Kobo quite a lot. I quite like their service, especially for Yen Press titles. I've talked about this before. Cool. So what about your choice, Andy?
So I figured we've actually had a couple of really important kind of manga luminaries pass away over the past couple of weeks. We had Monkey Punch, the author of Lupin, die, followed by I've forgotten his name.
Kazuo Koike.
Yes, the creator of Lone Wolf and Cub, which gave me a horrible realization that I've never read Lone Wolf and Cub, so this probably seems like an apt time to start. So I picked volume one of that.
Man, if I wanted to, I could give you a full education on the breadth and depth of Kazuo Koike's totally nutso mind. Back in my like baby podcaster days, when like a decade or so ago, when I was first listening to anime podcasts, and friggin' Anime World Order were flying the flag for his more intense sort of works, Gekiga works and such. Man, Oh, anyway, yeah, Lone Wolf and Cub is his most acclaimed and sort of like mainstreamized work. So I'm really interested. And I also, frankly, beyond reading it in a Borders one time while stood there, I have never read it fully. So it'd be good to visit the well acclaimed story of Samurai Man plus his kid in a murder pram. So we shall see. It's like a Hitman level, but, you know, in manga form. Cool. So, getting on to close down. Thank you everyone for listening. If you want to see more podcasts, you can go on to screentone.club, our website. Podcasts can be found on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, etc., etc. If you did like the podcast, please tell a friend, tweet about it. That stuff really, well, it makes our egos huge, but it's also really nice to see. Ratings and reviews also greatly, greatly appreciated. If you feel like being polite and leaving one. You can see our Twitter at Screentone Club, where we alert you about new episodes and also tell great jokes, ? And also we comment on how nice your guinea pigs are. So if you have pets, send us pictures and I will comment on how cute they look. Actual yes. thing.
Yes, indeed. Pet pictures are always welcome on any social media feeds, to be quite honest.
I don't tweet from the account often, but when I do, I demand more photos of guinea pigs. Stupid. If you want to email us, you can email show@screentone.club. For personal stuff, my name is Elliot Page, and you can find me at Elliot Page on Twitter, trying, as always, to post more pictures of my lovely cats, who, I don't know if it's been picked up on the recording, but has been yowling outside my door for the past 5 minutes. How about you, Andy?
Please don't at me about football or London Comic Con, but otherwise you can find me on Twitter at Hannahs1979.
Cool. Thank you everyone for listening. We will see you again. Well, you'll hear from us again in 2 weeks with our next episode of Screen Tone Club. Thanks for listening and goodbye.
Bye everyone.
Bye.